Here's something that doesn't get said enough in E&M spaces. Knowing your attachment style doesn't fix anything. You can read every book, you can take the quiz, get your results, announce yourself at the dinner table as anxiously attached like it's a diagnosis that explains everything. And then your partner goes on a date and you spend 4 hours refreshing your phone and the knowing doesn't help at all. Because your nervous system isn't reading the book. It's running a much older program. Today, we're going into the gap between what you know and what your body knows. That gap isn't a character flaw. It's not proof that polyamory isn't for you. It's where the actual work lives. Welcome to Untamed Ember. I'm Dr. Misty. This season, we've been tracking one argument, that the conditioning you didn't choose is running more of your relational life than you think. We spent one part in the cultural layer. Now we're in the nervous system, and today's episode is about one of the most powerful places that conditioning lives, in your attachment patterns, and in what happens to those patterns when you're building more than one relationship at a time. Let's start with what attachment theory actually is, because the pop psych version has done some real damage. Bowlby and Ainsworth, the researchers who developed attachment theory in the mid-20th century, we're studying something specific, how infants organize their behavior around a primary caregiver in order to maintain proximity and feel safe. What they found was that infants develop distinct strategies based on how reliably that caregiver responded, not based on how much the caregiver loved them, based on how predictable and consistent the caregiver was. Those strategies got labeled secure. Caregiver is reliable, child can explore and return. Anxious, caregiver is inconsistent, child amplifies distress signals to get a response. Avoidant, caregiver is consistently unresponsive or overwhelmed by emotion. Child learns to suppress attachment needs and self-regulate alone. Disorganized, caregiver is the source of both comfort and fear, which creates an impossible neurological bind. The thing that's supposed to make you feel safe is also the thing that scares you. Here's what that research is not saying. It was not saying that you are one of these four types forever. It was not saying your attachment style is a personality trait like being introverted or liking spicy food. It was describing adaptive strategies. Your nervous system learned to predict what relationships would do based on the earliest evidence it had. And it built a working model accordingly. What the quiz culture version of this does is take those adaptive strategies and turn them into identities. I'm an anxious attachment, as if the anxiety is the point, rather than the strategy your system developed to stay connected to someone who kept disappearing. The label can be useful as a starting point, but it becomes a problem when it replaces the question underneath it, which is, what did your nervous system learn relationships were, and is this still what's true? I want to bring in a composite client I'll call Kai. He uses he/him pronouns. He's in his mid-30s, he's been practicing polyamory for about 18 months, and he chose it. Nobody pressured him, nobody cheated. This was a genuine and considered decision about how he wanted to structure his relational life. Kai grew up in a household with a parent who was emotionally inconsistent. Not cruel, not absent in the way that leaves obvious marks, just unpredictable. Some days warm and available, other days withdrawn and hard to read. And there was no reliable signal for which version was showing up. So Kai's nervous system did what nervous systems do. It built a strategy. If I stay close enough, monitor carefully enough, make myself useful enough, I can keep the connection stable. Anxious attachment, textbook version. Fast forward to polyamory. Kai is thoughtful. He reads. He knows his pattern. He can tell you his attachment style, name his triggers, explain the neuroscience of jealousy. We talked about that in the last episode. And he kept running into the same wall. He'd meet a new partner, feel genuine connection, and his system would immediately start treating that connection like the relationship that would finally feel stable. He'd overinvest fast. He'd start monitoring. And when that partner showed up for their other relationships, completely normal as polyamory requires, Kai's nervous system read it as abandonment. Not intellectually, his intellect knew exactly what was happening. His body filed a completely different report. And that gap between what he knew and what his system was doing is where we spent a lot of our work together. Let's talk about why that gap exists and why polyamory in particular brings it into sharp relief. Here's the thing about monogamy and attachment patterns. Monogamy can hide them, not heal them, hide them. When you're in one relationship, your attachment system has one primary surface to interact with. If your partner is reasonably consistent and available, your system can settle into a predictable enough environment that the old strategies don't get triggered very often. You might think you've done your attachment work. You might think you're secure. And then you open up your relationship and discover that you have three different attachment responses happening simultaneously with three different people, and none of them look like each other. This is one of the most disorienting things people don't anticipate when they enter polyamory. The research on this is still developing, but what clinicians are consistently seeing is that attachment isn't a fixed trait you bring evenly to every relationship. It's context-dependent, relational. You can be genuinely securely attached with a long-term partner whose patterns are deeply known to your nervous system and completely disorganized with someone new whose rhythms your system hasn't mapped yet. You can be avoidant in relationships where you feel controlled and anxious in relationships where you feel uncertain of your place. Polyamory doesn't create this variability. It makes it visible. And visible is uncomfortable, but it's also workable. You can't address what you can't see. What I want you to understand about attachment patterns is that they're not emotional responses. They're predictive systems. Your nervous system is constantly running what neuroscientist Lisa Feldman Barrett calls a predictive model. It's using past experience to anticipate what's about to happen so it can prepare a response before the event fully lands. That is efficient. It's also where attachment patterns live. Your system learned early what relationships do, and now it's applying those predictions to every new relational input that it encounters. For someone with an anxious attachment history, the prediction is something like, connection is fragile, availability is conditional. I need to monitor and signal strongly to keep it. That prediction gets applied automatically. It doesn't wait for evidence. It doesn't check whether this person in front of you is actually your inconsistent parent. It just runs. For someone with an avoidant history, the prediction is closer to needing people leads to disappointment or overwhelm. Self-sufficiency is safer than dependence. Closeness has a cost, so the system manages distance. Not because the person doesn't want connection, often they want it desperately, but because the prediction says connection isn't safe to need. For someone with a disorganized history, the prediction is the most painful one. The person who is supposed to be safe is also the source of danger. So the nervous system gets stuck in an approach avoidance loop. Come close, pull back, repeat. In polyamorous dynamics, this can look chaotic from the outside, and it's absolutely exhausting from the inside. None of these predictions are wrong, given the data that they were built on. They were adaptive. The problem isn't that your nervous system learned the wrong thing. The problem is that it's still applying an old map to new territory. So this is exactly where Kai was. And what shifted for him was understanding that the goal isn't to stop having a nervous system. It's to build enough space between the prediction and the response that you can choose what you do with it. And that internal work, building space between the prediction and the response, is the thing that actually moves the needle. Which makes it especially frustrating that the advice most people get in E&M communities points them in almost the opposite direction. I want to address something that gets said a lot in E&M spaces because I think it does real harm. Work on your attachment before you open up. I understand the impulse. People see folks coming into polyamory with unprocessed, anxious, or avoidant patterns, and then struggling. And they conclude that the attachment work has to happen first. But that framing treats attachment as a prerequisite, a checkpoint you pass before you're allowed to try a different relational structure. And it's built on a misunderstanding of how attachment actually changes. Attachment patterns don't heal in isolation. They heal in relationship. The nervous system learns new predictions by having new experiences. Experiences where it risks connection and something different happens than it expected. You can't get that from a workbook alone. You can't think your way into a new predictive model. You have to have the experience with your whole body of reaching and being met, of needing something and it being there, of the thing your system was sure would happen not happening. What that means clinically is that the work happens in the relationships, not before them. It means having the somatic activation, learning to recognize it for what it is rather than fusing with it, developing enough regulatory capacity to stay in the conversation rather than escalating or shutting down, and over time, with enough repeated experiences, the nervous system starts to update its predictions. The more useful question isn't, have I healed my attachment? It's, do I have enough awareness and support to work with my nervous system inside the relationships that I'm building? Those are different questions, and the second one is actually answerable. When I talk about regulatory capacity, I'm not talking about emotional control. I'm not talking about learning to suppress what comes up or perform calm when your system is screaming. Regulatory capacity is the ability to stay in contact with what's happening in your nervous system without being fully hijacked by it. To notice the activation, name it with some accuracy, and maintain enough of a window of tolerance that you can choose your next move. We talked about window of tolerance in the context of jealousy last episode. The same framework applies here. For Kai, this looked like learning to catch the predictive moment, the exact second his system started running the old program. He described it as a kind of time compression, where his partner would say something completely normal, and suddenly he'd be in a different decade, running a different relationship, feeling feelings that were proportionally much bigger than the current situation warranted. What we worked on wasn't making that time compression stop. It was building a tiny bit of space inside it, just enough that he could notice it happening. Because once you can notice it, you have a choice. Before you can notice it, you only have a reaction. So the somatic piece of this matters, and I want to name it specifically. The nervous system doesn't update through cognitive reframing alone. It updates through body-level experience. So part of what Kai needed wasn't just the insight that his system was running on old predictions. He needed to physically experience something different happening. His partner saying, "I'm here," and his body being able to take that in rather than immediately cycling it through the old filter. That's slow work. It doesn't happen in one breakthrough conversation. It accumulates. Here's where Kai landed, and I want to be honest about what landed means in this context. He didn't stop having an anxious attachment system. He didn't become securely attached in the way the pop psych version promises. What changed was that he started to be able to tell the difference between a real relational signal and his system running an old prediction. He could feel the activation coming, name it to himself, and sometimes, not always, but sometimes, stay present in the actual moment rather than the remembered one. He also found that naming it to his partners changed things. Not as a warning or as a preemptive apology, but as information. Like, my system is doing the thing right now, I'm working on staying here. That level of transparency, when it lands with partners who can receive it, creates a co-regulatory loop. His partners learned what to offer. He learned to receive it. And the accumulated experience of being met in those moments started slowly to update the prediction. That's not a cure. It's not even a finish line. It's a practice. And it's what attachment work in polyamory actually looks like when it's going well. Not the absence of the old patterns, but a different relationship with them. So before we move into the reflection, I want to leave you with something to actually sit with this week. Pick one relationship in your life, not the hardest one, not the easiest one, somewhere in the middle, and get curious about the prediction your nervous system is running in it. Not your feelings about the person, the prediction. What does your body seem to believe that the relationship is going to do? Is that prediction based on this person, or is it older than they are? You don't have to do anything with the answer yet. Just see if you can find the prediction underneath the feeling. That's the first move. Next episode, we're going into compersion, what it actually is neurologically, why it's not the opposite of jealousy, and why forcing it tends to backfire. That's coming up. Before we close, I want to give you somewhere to land with this. Find a comfortable position. If it feels okay, close your eyes or soften your gaze toward the floor. I want to invite you to think about a moment, recently or not, when a relational interaction activated something in you that felt bigger than the moment warranted. Maybe you got quiet when you wanted to stay present. Maybe you reached harder than you meant to. Maybe you felt a pull to manage something that wasn't yours to manage. See if you can locate where that landed in your body. Not the story about it, the sensation, a tightening somewhere, a hollowness, a pull toward or a push away. That's not a character flaw. That's your nervous system doing the job it learned to do. It's been carrying that job for a long time. The invitation this episode is offering isn't to fix it. It's to get curious about it. What was your system predicting in that moment? Where did it learn to make that prediction? And gently, is there any small piece of evidence available to you right now that the prediction might not be the whole story? You don't have to change anything today. Just let yourself notice, and that's enough. This has been Untamed Ember. I'm Dr. Misty. The conditioning you didn't choose is real, and so is your capacity to build something different inside it, one body-level experience at a time. Subscribe to the Untamed Ember newsletter at untamedember.kit.com for deep dives, bonus material, and the behind-the-scenes content that doesn't make it into the episode. Next episode, compersion. What it actually is, what it isn't, and why you can't manufacture it no matter how evolved you want to be. We'll see you next time.